Bar and Grill. Trae juguete? Did he bring a toy? He already has a toy, Gabriel confirmed. He already has a toy. Gun, Robert told the wire room. Toy means gun. Robert headed down to the DEA parking lot. The console of his Jeep Cherokee was full of radios, one each from FBI, DEA, and Laredo PD. He ordered 10 unmarked units stationed near the safe house to head toward Cosmo's Bar and Grill. Then he drove there. There were two driveways in and out of the Cosmo's lot, an unmarked unit parked near each. Another unit located the blue Hummer parked nearby. A 6-man SWAT team stationed itself in an armored vehicle a quarter mile away behind some water tanks. Robert hid himself in a lot across the street behind a standalone Sprint store, headlights off, AC on. He listened to his three radios. Within 2 minutes, an unmarked unit reported that it spotted men who fit the descriptions of the sicarios from the safe house. How about Cardona? Robert asked. Negative. Don't see him yet. Outside Robert's car, traffic cruised by. Cosmos was part of the nightclub strip in central Laredo, including Tonic and District and F-Bar. Lots of SUVs and pickup trucks came and went. Every second vehicle in Laredo was a pickup. A pickup came by that moved more slowly than the others. The blue Dodge Ram held up traffic, oblivious to the cars accumulating behind it. The driver of the Ram rubbernecked at Cosmos but didn't pull into the lot. Instead, the driver of the Ram pulled into a lot kitty-corner to the one Robert was in and parked near a bank, backing into the spot so the nose of the Ram pointed at Cosmos. The driver was young, looked about 20, wore a black polo golf shirt and khakis. I got him, Robert said. Gabriel was on his phone, using the push-button walkie-talkie function. A slight delay, then the wire room relayed Gabriel's call back to Robert. Mackie is the one we're going to kill, Gabriel told Rocky, who was now parked near Cosmos as well. Before Mackie gets into his truck, you call JP and you tell him, there goes Mackie, there goes Mackie, he's the one wearing such and such. JP is the only one I'm supposed to call? Just him? Yes, just him. He'll do the job, and then another guy will be waiting around the corner for the getaway. Okay, Robert thought. They had enough on this attempted murder. Mackie is the one we're going to kill. Robert ordered 2 marked cop cars to pull into the Cosmos lot, flash their lights, and sit there. The squad cars would spook Cardona, make him cancel the job. The squad cars pulled into the Cosmos lot and flashed their light. Gabriel didn't move. Robert watched Gabriel watch the cop cars. Gabriel got back on his radio. The wire room relayed the call to Robert. Gabriel wanted his crew to stay in place until Mackie left Cosmos. They would let Mackie get into his blue Hummer, let him drive away, then follow him. They would each take turns tailing him for a little while, then drop back and let the other take the lead, like cyclists in a peloton. They would do so, Gabriel instructed, until Mackie got somewhere isolated, alone, and then Gabriel would kill Mackie himself. 60 minutes passed. The nightclub cleared out. It was 2 a.m. The owner of the blue Hummer pushed through the doors. His eyes took a moment to adjust to the halogen lamps in the parking lot. He climbed into the Hummer. When he turned the ignition, Robert issued an order to the squad cars. Pull Mackie over as soon as he hits the road. The wire room conveyed another conversation to Robert. What's up, Way? Gabriel asked. Where's the Hummer going? He's coming out through the north side, Rocky said. The north side. He's leaving the lot. But, there are 2 cops behind him.
The north side? Like he's heading toward Del Mar?
Yeah. The north side. But be careful, man. The cop cars are right behind him. Okay, I'm headed over there.
He's parked, Rocky said. The police pulled him over.
¿Qué onda?
Pinche puto, Rocky said. This culero is very lucky.
Let's wait and see if they let him leave.
All right. I'm watching everything.
It looks like they're arresting the guy. It looks like they're handcuffing him, like they're going to take the puto away. Do you think he was drunk or what? A tow truck came and hauled the Hummer away. The Wolf Boys departed. Robert walked across the street to the squad car and looked in back. The man inside was not Mackey. He was a local dentist who looked a little like Mackey and owned a blue Hummer that looked just like Mackey's. The dentist was apoplectic over why his car was being towed while he sat in a police cruiser. Robert said some hitmen almost killed him. "We arrested you to protect you."
"It's my fucking wife, isn't it?" the dentist screamed.
The dentist's wife had nothing to do with it, Robert assured him.
"She must have hired them. I know it. We're going through a divorce. She wants me dead."
Back in the wire room, the main members of Team Prophecy collapsed on the couches, highly emotional after the close call. What the fuck just happened? For them, the only thing worse than getting burned, having the bad guys find out about the investigation and split, was getting someone killed. Operation Prophecy, they realized now, would be no typical wiretap investigation, where you could use your informant to wield some control over the criminal's actions. The boys had their own agenda and would do whatever they wanted. Team Prophecy decided to keep the operation going so they could record conversations between Gabriel and company leaders in Mexico, and so Rocky could find out who else was on the hit list. They would have to be in a reactive mode constantly. Only 12 hours had passed since they gave Cardona the keys to the safe house. How long could they keep up with these kids? That night, Gabriel and Richard went looking for an old and familiar target on Miguel's list, Mike Lopez, at Taco Palenque, where Minnie and Laredo went after the bars closed, but they couldn't find him. Driving north on I-35, Richard noticed they were being followed by an unmarked car, a white Ford Explorer. Richard sped away. The Explorer followed. Richard exited the highway, made a U-turn beneath the underpass, and got on I-35 heading south. He stepped on it, exited at Saunders Street, called ahead to a friend who lived nearby, asked him to open his front gate, and a few minutes later Richard and Gabriel pulled into a driveway and shut off their lights.
"Lost them," Gabriel said.
The Explorer drove by slowly.
"Fuck,"
Richard said.
"The FBI must be investigating the kids," Gabriel said, referring to Poncho Aviles and the other Laredo teen,
both Sinaloans whom Gabriel and Richard kidnapped from a Nuevo Laredo nightclub a week earlier. Gabriel shrugged it off. Those murders were done on the other side, he assured Richard, so it didn't matter. Still, the tale made Richard skittish.
"We're calling too much attention to ourselves," Richard said.
He wanted to call it a night and go to Nuevo Laredo while the heat cooled.
"You catching that pussy, man," Gabriel said. "Let's do this job."
Gabriel and Richard never differed so openly. The argument's subtext was clear. During their younger years in La Azteca, Richard had the money and the power. He was the boss. Now the roles had reversed. Deep down, Richard was angry at himself. 6 months earlier, he got into the killings for what seemed like a good reason, to meet Miguel Trevino and get back to smuggling. In recent months, Richard and Miguel had had many conversations about Richard getting back into logistics with a startup grant and all the cocaine he could move. Miguel trusted Richard because Richard was with Gabriel. Every time they saw each other, Miguel asked if Richard was ready to start a new smuggling operation. Richard always invented an excuse. The real reason being that the assassin's power to instill fear had sapped his ambition to work hard and make real money again. Fear, over the long term, might be a weaker power than money, but in some ways it was a more addictive one. It was one thing to have money and be able to get out of a jam with Mexican authorities, but you still had to go by their rules, because enemies might have more money and therefore more power over the cops. Whereas the power of fear meant running off cops without paying them. The privilege to humiliate had seduced Richard, and he'd lost his way.
"We're looking for a fucking ghost," Richard said. "I'm done for today."
Then Gabriel's phone rang. It was Mamé Flores calling from Mexico. Mamé explained that there were two young company men in Nuevo Laredo who were taking their weekly salaries but never doing jobs. They needed to be disciplined. Could Gabriel handle it? In an endless war, the enforcer's work was never done. Yes, Gabriel said. He could do it. Okay, he told Richard. You get your wish. Take us across. Later, Richard stayed in Mexico to continue partying. Gabriel returned to the safe house on Orange Blossom Loop in the pre-dawn hours. It had been a long night. He slept. Sunday passed without activity. On Monday, the third day in the safe house, Robert watched the boys. None of the bedrooms had cameras, but he could imagine Gabriel sleeping on the deluxe air mattress bought at Walmart. While plainclothes officers followed them through the aisles earlier that day, the boys bought bedding, kitchen utensils, and a triangular cabinet for the old TV, the singular living room item furnished by the U.S. government. At noon, the Wolf boys woke up and Gabriel went into his neat freak mode, putting each associate on a task. Clean the kitchen, the bathroom, find a mower and cut the lawn, assemble the TV stand. This place was going to be a straight house, he told them, not a dump. They would all learn to respect what they'd been given. He unwrapped the kitchen utensils, filled a drawer, went to the garage and came back with an armful of Martha Stewart towels, new white ones with stripes, some of which he hung on the rack, and the rest he distributed around to the other Wolf boys. Now, in his bedroom, where Robert could hear but not see, Gabriel tried to make up with Christina on the phone. "Are you busy or what?" she asked. He could hear his underlings working away in the garage. "I'm cleaning the car," Gabriel said into the phone. "What's up, love?"
"I was checking in because you haven't called."
"All right." An uncomfortable silence.
"Help me be strong, Gabriel," she finally said with a heave. "I don't have anyone else. You don't understand how I feel when you don't call me. It just feels so terrible."
Gabriel's renewed dedication to his company work, specifically this killing spree in Texas, put major stress on their relationship. She'd call him about plans and he'd say, "You don't understand. I'm working."
"But you said we were going to be together."
"Fine, I'll come get you." And Gabriel would come get her, and they'd go somewhere for fast food, and Gabriel would bitch at her to reorganize the pickles on his burger, to lay them out evenly so that there was one pickle for each bite. She could no longer claim ignorance of his work. Not since the recent night he returned from Mexico and removed his black Versace shirt, which hung so attractively over the late adolescent bulk. She noticed it was splattered red. A rumor floated. Two kids from Laredo were taken from the Eclipse nightclub in Nuevo Laredo, beaten and stewed in the guiso. Shacked up at another hotel, Gabriel asked Christina if she wanted a new car. She said she'd love a new car. She could have any car she wanted, he said, so long as she helped him deliver La Barbie's head in a box.
"What the fuck, Gabriel?" she yelled.
"What?" he shrugged. She clucked her tongue against the roof of her mouth, what she did when she was sad. They could be good together, strong, she thought, but the company was coming between them, and she was tired of it. "You know sometimes I can't call," Gabriel now told her on the wiretapped phone. "I've been busy, and if you don't believe me, just look at Chuy Resendez." She breathed deeply, exasperated.
"I know. I don't want to know."
She said someone was offering $1,000 for information about the murder.
"I understand you're busy, Gabriel. But when you love somebody, like really love them, you try to make at least a little bit of time to call. At least a little bit of time. I fucking love you."
They agreed to meet for dinner in 2 days. She said be careful. They hung up. In the wire room, Diaz and Gomez rolled on the floor. Robert chuckled. They could almost empathize. The kid would do life because his girlfriend was lonely. 28. Twilight. A big gulp sat on the kitchen island in the house on Orange Blossom Loop, and each boy sipped from it as they milled around and constructed the TV stand purchased at Walmart. Gabriel pulled up his shirt and showed off a new back tattoo of Santa Muerte, the goddess of death. A hooded skull holding a scythe and globe. The scythe symbolized the cutting of negative energies. As a harvesting tool, it also stood for prosperity. The skull represented death's dominion over the earth, while the globe meant both power and oblivion, the tomb to which they all would return. During Gabriel's most recent stint in the Webb County Jail, he'd become a Santa Muerte devotee. When he first arrived at the jail in early February, the guards housed him in a segregated unit. He prayed to Santa Muerte. The next day, the guards moved him to the tanks. He prayed to her again, this time for the lawyer to come, then discovered that David Almaraz was on his way. He prayed for a bond reduction and got it. Now the boys took turns rubbing the tattoo. They agreed it was cool. Gabriel sat on the living room floor, his back against the wall, and chatted with Rocky.
¿Qué onda? Rocky asked. What's up?
Esperando que crucen los dos sicarios. Entonces Checo,
Gabriel replied, waiting for the two hitmen to cross over, then Checo.
Checo?
Rocky confirmed for the benefit of the wire room.
Sí. ¿En qué área vive?
Rocky asked. What area does he live in? Gabriel said,
Chincaro, no sé.
Shit, I don't know.
Todavía no me dicen. No más me dijeron, consigue los muebles y los sicarios listos y los fieros.
They still haven't told me. They just told me, get the vehicles and the hitmen ready and the guns. Gabriel mentioned other targets, including Mike Lopez, and said there were a total of 40 targets, several of whom had already been killed. Rocky nodded, then said,
si quieres, yo me puedo encargar de ubicar la gente. Tú nomás me dices va a hacer este.
If you want, I can take charge of locating the people. You just tell me it's going to be this one and this one and this one.
Simón, Gabriel said, right on. ¿Por qué no puedes salir muchas veces, hijo?
Rocky added.
Because you can't go out too much, son. Yo sé, pero con Checo ahorita ya está en corto. No hay pedo.
I know. But right now, Checo is about to happen. There's no problem. Rocky asked how Checo would be killed, and Gabriel explained.
Mike dijo, ¿Cómo tú piensas? Mientras ustedes lo hagan bien.
Mike said, however you want, as long as you guys do it well. Gabriel said that because he'd heard Checo was very trusting, he thought that whoever killed Checo could simply yell Checo's name. Hey, Checo! Then walk up to his car and shoot him. Rocky asked what cars Gabriel needed. Gabriel said he needed a used car that cost around $5,000, a car with front-wheel drive and an 8-cylinder engine. An Alero, Gabriel said, would be a good car for doing hits because bystanders often confuse Aleros with Mustangs. Rocky suggested a car that doesn't call attention to itself, something
chiquito y tranquilo. Pero bueno y efectivo.
Small and calm, but good and effective. Rocky suggested putting bumper stickers on it, maybe political stickers or kid stickers as cover. Gabriel's phone rang. He stood up, answered the call, and paced. He spoke to Wolf Boy Associates based in another Laredo safe house about locating a target named Teofo. Robert scribbled down all the names Gabriel mentioned, including Teofo, and wondered,
how did he know Teofo? Ah, yes.
A hitman for La Barbie, Teofo had given Robert the Barbie execution video the previous summer. Robert sent out a list of the targets to Laredo PD with instructions to contact the targets and their families. It was a start. But what about the other targets on the list? There were 40? Later that day, Gabriel tried to put together a small cocaine deal. Between gifts to his family and friends and his company-related work expenses, which often weren't reimbursed, the money from the Chewy Resendez job was already gone. Gabriel had sent his buddy, a minor wolf boy named Camacho, to pick up 10 ounces of coke from a Laredo dealer. First, Camacho called to say that the scale had run out of battery power and blah, blah, blah. Then Camacho called and said it was only just over 4 ounces.
What do you mean 4? Gabriel asked.
Why are you saying that?
4 ounces, dude.
4? It's like 4 plus a little, but I hope...
I'm not going to work with you anymore if you're going to be doing this shit.
Now, we came up with 10 ounces, so don't come with that shit that there are four. As a matter of fact, I'm going to call him right now, and if he gives me his word that there were 10... No, man, wait. I mean, there are 9 3/8. Almost 10. I was saying 4 because I already have 5 for you and another glass I already weighed.
Gabriel shook his head. Did these pendejos think they were smarter than him? All right, call me later so I know how much it is exactly. Camacho laughed.
You almost had a heart attack, dude.
All right.
You were going to kill me.
When the coke arrived, Gabriel wanted his driver, Chapa, to mule it to Dallas on a bus. A buyer would give $5,000 for 10 ounces, a $3,000 profit. They discussed how Chapa could hide the coke during an 8-hour bus ride.
Stuff it down my pants?
Nah.
Between the seat cushions?
I know, Gabriel said, grabbing the big gulp. You wrap it up really tight, like watertight, and hide the coke in the coke. That way, when they pull the bus over for checks, you can just carry the cup out and keep sipping.
The boys liked it. Had Richard been there, he would have rolled his eyes. 10 ounces? That was personal use. Why risk a case for such a small score? Shit, even DEA would laugh at that.
In the wire room, Robert smirked. If he were a doper, he'd rent a house in Laredo under a false name, furnish it, fill the furniture with drugs, then hire a moving company to take the furniture to an apartment in New York. He never heard of anyone doing it. Maybe it would work. He took a break while Diaz and Gomez jotted notes on the drug stuff. Conspiracy to traffic, more charges, more years. Behind them, hanging on the wall, was a whiteboard with a couple dozen photos attached. On top was Miguel Trevino. Below were members of Gabriel's crew, some of them flunkies, like Chapa, some of them bona fide wolf boys. Robert had drawn lines from Gabriel, in the middle of the board, to various Zeta superiors. In addition to foiling the hits, the goal in the coming days would be to use wiretaps to bolster connections within the hierarchy and come away with enough evidence not simply to put Gabriel away for good, but to indict the top of the hierarchy as well. On the morning of the fourth day, Robert woke to the ping of a new call on the wire. He knew the voice on the other end. When a guy threatened your family, you never forget his voice.
I just started here and already several people got whacked, Bart reported to Gabriel. It's like, hey, kill that guy, and boom.
Bart was in Mexico traveling with Miguel's escolta. Bart said he was resting, playing video games on Xbox 360 and smoking weed while he tended to a nasty wound. During a raid the previous day, he had shot himself in the leg with an armor-piercing bullet.
We were like 7 cars armored. I was in a nice green marquee. We were cruising around, and then we arrived at the house. I got off and went inside through the back. I had piñas, the whole shit. They were all on the ground. It was awesome. Bang, bang. Then the rats came. I took off in a hurry. My leg felt hot. I looked down. It's one of those holes where I'm missing flesh from my leg.
Bart laughed hysterically.
I'm missing flesh from my leg, dude. That says it all.
Gabriel said, I'm going to go there and you'll see the sweeping I'm going to make. In the meantime, I'm going to continue here a little longer. By the way, have you seen Richard over there?
Negative.
He's been gone 2 days. If he doesn't come back, he's a deserter. There was a pause. The good thing is that I haven't done anything, dude. We have heat, but things are calm right now because we were just hiding. Once we got out, that's it. Bang, bang, bang. We do the action. I don't do anything. I direct on the radio. The guy's here. He's there. Get off and shoot him down. Richard and the one from Dallas, JP, they are going to be doing the killing.
I know those are sure shots.
Gabriel and Bart filled each other in on their living situations. Gabriel said his room was smaller than the others, but fancier.
What do I need a big room for if I don't have much furniture?
They talked about guns, bullets, and vests. They discussed the virtues of the FN Herstal, the gun that many company men had been given. The flat trajectory of the 5.7 by 28 millimeter bullet all but guaranteed a hit in close quarter scenarios, plus it had a low recoil. Bart yawned. He said it freaked him out what a 50 caliber bullet did to someone's head. Bart asked about the status of a debt that Gabriel owed him. Gabriel was supposed to repay the debt out of the Chuy Resendez money. He explained,
"Shit, dude, I spent it. There were 50. I gave 20 to Richard. I had 30 left. I spent 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 on the Mercedes for a grill, bumper, fan, fog lights, and a new paint job. From the remaining 22, I gave 1,000 to Choppa and 1 to my little brother. So that's 20. From those 20, I bought 2,000 worth of clothes. That's 18. I spent on hotels. That's 14. Of those 14, I gave 10 to my mother. I have 4 left. From those 4, I used 2 to buy the 10 ounces. So let's say for now that I only have 2,000.
Bart was suspicious that Gabriel was holding out on him, but accepted the explanation. Gabriel asked if Bart heard about the Sinaloan teens, Poncho Aviles and Inez Villarreal, whom Richard and Gabriel kidnapped from the Eclipse nightclub.
Nah, where did you cook them?
That house on kilometer 14. You should have seen Poncho. He was crying like a faggot.
No, man, I'm your friend.
What friend, you son of a bitch? Shut your mouth. And boom, I grabbed a fucking bottle and slash, I slitted his whole fucking belly. I grabbed a little cup and filled it with blood and boom, I dedicated it to my holy death, to my Santa Muerte. And then I went to the other faggot and slash.
Gabriel said he believed the FBI was getting involved, but that wasn't a problem because the murders were done on the other side. The conversation shifted to company leadership. Bart said Miguel and Omar turned up at the safe house where Bart was healing and showed everyone an updated hit list, including more people they believed were involved in the killing of Fito. Gabriel and Bart complained about Miguel, about how he didn't always respect them, but always came back later calling them brother when he wanted something.
"Ask El Comandante if you can come back here," Gabriel said. "Tell him I've got the next punto lined up," referring to the Sinaloan smuggler known as Checo. "If you want, you can help."
Robert, his eyes raw from lack of sleep, walked to the whiteboard, stepping over burger wrappers and pizza boxes. He uncapped a marker, drew lines from Miguel Trevino to Omar Trevino to Mame Flores and other company brass mentioned by code in the call. The lines between the Wolf Boys and their Mexican bosses were firming up. But there was a problem. Miguel's hit list contained 40 targets, possibly more. Operation Prophecy would never learn them all through wiretaps alone. From now on, it would be a constant cost-benefit analysis. How much was more information about the cartel and their targets worth against the risk of letting Gabriel and his crew run around Laredo? Cosmos had been a too close call. They didn't need another one. What they wanted most was a conversation between Gabriel and Miguel, and on the fourth day in the safe house, Tuesday, April 11th, they got it.
"What's going on, man?" Miguel asked Gabriel over the phone.
"I bought the 2 vehicles on the other side," Gabriel said, referring to cars he bought in Mexico. "One is a green Malibu, the other a white Marquis."
"And who is it going to be?" Miguel asked, referring to who would kill the next target, Checo.
"Who's my man?"
"I'm one sicario short," Gabriel said, referring to Richard, who hadn't yet returned from Mexico.
"But if you want, we can do Checo right now."
"Let me see," Miguel said. "Show me what you've got."
"Okay, once I put together the cuadro, the team, I'll call you to let you know that we are on our way there."
Gabriel headed out to pick up Christina from school and have an early dinner. At Applebee's, he apologized for not calling more.
"I do love you," he said. "It's just work."
"I know. I don't want to talk about that anymore."
They ordered orange sodas and waited for their sandwiches. She mentioned she'd heard people refer to him as Comandante Gabi. This information delighted Gabriel. It could only mean that Miguel was talking about Gabriel coming up in the company. His phone rang. A Wolf Boy at the safe house reported that 2 guys had just knocked on the door. One tall, one short and chubby. The short one was dark-skinned, had glasses. I think it might have been Robert.
"Don't worry," Gabriel assured him. "It wasn't Robert. The cops have no idea where I am."
The men waited, knocked again, waited some more, knocked a third time, then walked away. The associate confirmed it wasn't Robert.
I think they were actually real estate men because they were wearing ties and long-sleeve shirts. It was a nice April day. Gabriel and Christina drove to Lake Casablanca and took a stroll in the park that surrounded the lake just south of the TAMIU campus, where University President Ray Keck lectured on 100 Years of Solitude in the original Spanish and Isaiah Berlin's view of Machiavelli. The teen lovers walked in and out of the reedy peninsulas that jutted into the water. Gabriel told her about how he and his Lazteca hoodies, whenever they got some money, used to come to the lake back in the day, rent lanchitas, little airboats, and make carne asada. Nostalgic, they shared a shivery kiss.
"Don't worry," she said. "I haven't told anybody. I play dumb. I don't even want to know."
She sighed, clucked her tongue.
"I like fighting together, Gabriel, but the Zetas are starting to hurt."
"I know, my love, but I have to keep helping him. What can I do? There is nothing I can do with this man. That's the way it is, Christina." The reeds blew against their jeans. He told her he had a new place and wanted to bring her to live there. When he dropped her off at home, he gave her $500. He'd call soon and tell her when to pack. They hugged.
"Tighter," she said.
A couple of hours later, when Gabriel and Richard finally spoke on the phone, Gabriel said he'd been looking for Richard for a long time.
"I hope I'm not disturbing you," Gabriel said sarcastically.
"I'm here at La Quinta," Richard said, referring to the Laredo Hotel where he'd been entertaining weekend girls.
"Well, they called and... Chaco."
"All right," Richard said, and told Gabriel he'd come back to the safe house. On his way, he stopped for a quick dinner at Subway, and while eating, saw one of the Orange Blossom crew drive by in the white marquee. The marquee, Richard saw, was being followed by a white explorer. He called Gabriel about the tale, but Gabriel told Richard that he was being paranoid.
"Man, you catching that pussy again."
At the safe house, with Richard finally back, the Wolf boys circulated in and out of the kitchen, swinging their arms, touching their toes. Two of them wiped the cars down. The cars had fake tags, paper dealer plates filled out with random sequences of numbers and letters. Stalking the house with quick steps, the Wolf boys readied themselves for the evening's work. In slacks and a new white polo shirt, Gabriel stood in the kitchen and squared up his newest recruit. The kid, JP, had come from Dallas with no clothes, so Gabriel lent him a Scarface t-shirt. He gave the kid a last-minute tutorial. "You walk up to him and just boom, en la cabezota, but with both hands, in the crown, boom, you'll fuck him up. Otherwise, boom, 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 four in the chest, and then en la cabezota to make sure." They were young and vigorous, fiery in their belief of success. "It's time to take care of business," Gabriel yelled to the group, clapping encouragement. Everything was ready. This was it. This was the beginning of something. Christina went to the mall with the $500, bought shirts and shoes and earrings, then went home to take a nap. She dreamed of packing a suitcase and joining him for a new life. A life in which promises were kept and men didn't disappear. A life in which people respected faith and worked hard to get closer to God. Awaking in twilight, she called his phone, like pinching herself, to make sure it was real. No one answered. Robert considered the options. They had hoped to keep the wire going for longer, but the kids were too active. Well, he had what he needed. They all did. So as dusk settled, he dispatched a SWAT team to Orange Blossom Loop, then headed for the parking lot a minute before the wire room's main screen whited out in an incandescent blaze. A commotion outside, boots, loud voices, a slamming, bang! In the kitchen, Richard and Gabriel met eyes, Richard shaking his head in disappointment. "I told you so," Gabriel in disbelief. A stun grenade came through the front door. The concussive blast disturbed the fluid in Gabriel's ears. He wobbled. A bright flash bleached the photoreceptors in his eyes, making vision impossible for 3 seconds. One, two, three. He was face down on the carpet, hands cuffed behind him. He thought he might die. He thought he might get out of it.
the world of possibility was vast. Then he heard that familiar voice. How you doing, Gabby? And he knew his outcomes had been reduced to one. She called again and again, but no one answered. There was a knock at her front door. Robert Garcia had two uniformed cops and a van idling. He told her that she needed to come to the station.
But I don't know anything, she said.
He smiled. Just look at what you're wearing, he said, referring to the clothes bought with Gabriel's murder money.
What?
She said, looking down at herself. They're new. They're covered in blood.
Deal?
Gabriel said into the phone, having called Miguel. Call back later. Someone, not Miguel, replied. He's busy.
The thing is, they caught me, Gabriel said. I don't know if they're going to lock me in. I just want to let you know.
Who's going to lock you in?
The law. I'm here in the office of the law. They came and told me, here, this is your radio. Use it however you want. Your right is to call your relatives so they know what's up. They raided our house. They're saying we did what happened to Chewy.
They're just blaming you for that?
They haven't told me yet. The freaking lawyer won't answer. He's got his phone turned off. They brought in my woman and they were putting pressure on her, like over and over. They wanted her to say I did that. I went rascal on them, man. I gave them a tough time.
Listen, Way, fuck them.
They're investigating Rocky and the other buddies, too. I don't know if the others are going to say something. I was standing up to the FBI and telling them to go fuck themselves, so they put me in a room alone.
Let them check you out. Those faggots are always making mistakes.
Yeah. No, I'm just letting you know, but it's no problem. I'm going to call the attorney so he can get me out of here. But let Uncle Mike know. Just let my friend over there know, okay?
Part 5. Frozen in Time. For the warrior, fame was the immediate point of it all. The glances of the women, the adulation of the children, the careful respect of one-time peers. Aztecs, Inga Clendenin. 29. Legend of Laredo. In the office of the law, Gabriel tried a new tactic. When talking could have helped him, he said nothing and cut no deal. Fear and prudence trumped pride. Motivated by a wish to protect his family from the company, he decided not to contest his case nor cut his sentence by snitching on the Zetas, and instead be the stand-up guy that Angel Moreno had rarely seen in 20 years as a prosecutor. For his alleged roles in the murders of Bruno Orozco, Moises Garcia, Noe Flores, Chuy Resendez, and Chuy's nephew, he pleaded guilty. His 3 50-year sentences and 2 80-year sentences would all run concurrently, meaning he'd serve a total of 80 years in state prison. As for his wiretapped confession to the murder by beating of the 2 American teens in Nuevo Laredo, Poncho Aviles and Inez Villarreal, it didn't matter that no bodies or evidence had been collected, nor even that the murders occurred in Mexico. Though there were many options for charging Gabriel, Moreno let him plead guilty to one charge, a new post-9/11 federal law intended to be used against Americans who enlisted with a terrorist group and went abroad to fight. It covered the murder of an American by an American on foreign soil. Moreno's federal indictment in Operation Prophecy named more than 30 defendants, including Miguel and Omar Trevino, Rene Garcia, and even the Black Hand, the Mexican mafia leader. When Gabriel and Richard appeared for their 2008 arraignment in federal court, Gabriel, having decided to plead guilty, balked a little before the judge.
I didn't know I was giving up my right to appeal in the plea bargain, he told Judge Michaela Alvarez.
Judge Alvarez explained that if he didn't want to give up his right to appeal, then it was the government's right, Moreno's right, to pull the plea agreement and head to trial. Gabriel relented.
I'll go ahead and give up my right to appeal.
Judge Alvarez wanted to make sure he understood what giving up his appeal meant. Let's say I sentence you to life, which is a possibility, she said. You're sitting in prison, you're thinking, my lawyer didn't do a good job for me. My lawyer should have fought harder. If you file a notice of appeal, it's kind of funny to say people still file them even though they gave up their right, the first thing the government is going to do is say, hey, wait a minute, he gave up his right. And the Fifth Circuit, the Federal Court of Appeals, will say, yeah, he gave up his right. Now, the other thing I talked about, the 2255. Let's say you're sitting in prison. You're talking to prisoners, and they say, you know what? There is something you can file called a 2255, a so-called collateral attack that can be filed by a defendant within a year of sentencing. I look at it. I say I explained all of this to him. I told him he wouldn't be able to do this. Do you understand? Yes, ma'am. Moreno then read aloud the facts that the government intended to prove if the case went to trial. The disappearances of Pancho Aviles and Inez Villarreal, their murder by torture, Gabriel's admission on the 17-minute phone call with Bart. When Moreno was done, Judge Alvarez asked Gabriel, are there any actions here attributed to you that you would say you did not engage in? No, everything is correct, Gabriel said. He denied only the statements attributed to him in which he allegedly talked about third parties. He wished not to be on the record as having discussed Miguel Trevino, Mamey Flores, or any other company leader. Gabriel's sentencing date came 7 months later. At the sentencing hearing, when Judge Alvarez asked if any victims wished to address the court, the mother of 14-year-old Inez Villarreal stepped forward. She could have been speaking for thousands of Laredo mothers when she explained how she lost a year of work looking for her son and was about to lose her house and car as well. She addressed Gabriel directly. I am going to tell you this, son, because I know your mother is going through the pain that I am, but the stronger sorrow is mine, because your mother knows where you are. I ask you, even if you want me to ask on my knees, if you know where my son is buried, please tell the judge. The judge thanked her, told Gabriel to give his attorney any information he had about the whereabouts of Inez Villarreal, and then asked if he had anything to say on his own behalf. The young man who once aspired to be an attorney said, I apologize to the government of the United States and to the community of Laredo for having participated in these kind of crimes. And just give me the least amount of sentence that you can. That's all. Thank you. Gabriel's lawyer in the federal case, Jeff Czar, urged the judge to give Gabriel some hope in terms of a light at the end of the tunnel. Czar argued that Gabriel's personality was a strong one, but disagreed that he supervised other parties. There's nothing that shows us that his intelligence is such that he was somehow brighter or smarter than the rest of that group. Czar said drugs played an aggravating role, that Gabriel was a high school dropout and lived on the streets most of his life. The history and characteristics of my client are not good. There's nothing I can do about that in the report. There's no way to doctor it up. The facts being tossed about, true or not, had, he claimed, turned his client into an urban legend. Angel Moreno replied, since the arrests of Gabriel and his crew 3 years earlier, Laredo's murder rate dropped to less than half of what it was when they were operating, Moreno argued. He emphasized Gabriel's leadership role and that he had direct contact with cartel heads in Mexico. He was the one that was calling the shots. Although Gabriel was young, he was no younger than the men and women who served our country in war. He was arrested several times. Regrettably, he was always released on bond. But he had plenty of opportunity to stop. As to whether this case has become a legend, Your Honor, I would say 90% of what's in the report came directly from him. His statements, his admissions, the interceptions of the calls, the videos. Maybe, in his head, it was romantic to be part of this group and engaged in these activities. If it's become a legend, it's become a legend because the defendant has elected to make it so. The judge conceded that Gabriel was not in charge of the entire organization, but said the record clearly reflected that he was in charge of at least his own particular group. Whether a problem of environment, DNA, or drugs, or because he lived in a fantasy world where he thought committing these murders glorified him, The judge concluded that, bilingual though he may be, she and Gabriel did not speak the same language, the language of humanity. She said, "Very frankly, I see nothing in this report to indicate that you have any consideration for your fellow human beings. For the safety of Laredo, for the safety of the entire United States, a sentence of life imprisonment," she held, "was warranted. He was lucky," she said. In her opinion, he deserved the death penalty. There were still many arraignments to come on the Operation Prophecy indictment, but, observing Gabriel's sentencing from the back benches, Robert was disappointed. The media feted Laredo law enforcement for the case, narrating a TV documentary about Gabriel and Bart, an actor from The Sopranos called Robert the Sherlock Holmes of the Tex-Mex border. But Robert had hoped Gabriel would contest the federal charge and take the case to trial. He wanted the snitches to be paraded onto the witness stand, the curtain pulled back on the gruesome reign of Miguel Trevino, a man who was only a few years into his ascent in the company when he told Gabriel and Wences that he'd killed more than 800 people. Back in 2006, 3 months after Operation Prophecy stepped on the safe house, there had been hope of a big Zeta trial in Laredo. In Mexico, Bart Reyta had defied Zeta orders and attacked a nightclub in Monterrey, killing 4 and wounding others. Without company protection, he landed in the hands of Mexican authorities. When they arrested Bart, they raided his house and found $275,000 in cash, a bulletproof BMW M3, a diamond ring valued at $25,000, and about $50,000 of new Versace clothes. Psychological evaluations judged Bart's condition as personality dissociative disorder, and concluded he was not only unstable, but a security threat to whichever institution housed him. Each country had different extradition requirements. If Moreno wanted to extradite someone from Canada, he sent a small envelope of papers. Mexico was at the other end of the spectrum. Their system demanded a truckload of paperwork. Extradition took years or didn't happen at all. But Mexico offered up Bart without a single document filed, and Bart was eager to get out of Mexico. If he stayed, he faced the wrath of the Zetas. In Texas, he believed authorities had only weak evidence linking him to the murders of Moises Garcia and Noe Flores. So, on the day after Bart turned 17, July 28, 2006, Robert met the mythic killer in the middle of the night on a tarmac at the San Antonio airport. Handcuffed and shackled, Bart grinned widely and recited the license plate number of Robert's undercover car. For several days in the interrogation room, over Bart's requested meal of Wendy's spicy chicken sandwiches and bottles of Big Red with cups of crushed ice, Bart told Robert stories from his time in the company. "Killing made him feel like James Bond and Superman," he said. "He was basically a detective, just like Robert. He had a job like any man, and he was good at his job. He never showed emotions. One minute you were having fun, kicking it like brothers, and the next minute he was putting a bullet to your head. No, it wasn't normal, he knew that. And yes, at first he did it for the money, but after a while it got addictive. He couldn't stop. He used to get a high out of it. It got to the point where if he didn't kill someone that day, he wasn't satisfied. Taking the gun away," he said, "was like taking candy from a baby. Shit, he was so gone he could have killed his own father and felt nothing." Their blood-soaked chatter assumed a weird, affable normality. Robert and Bart spoke nonchalantly of live humans fed to tigers and burned in oil drums, of hacking and torture, of the camps. Miguel Trevino was a smart man, Bart believed, and ruthless. Miguel trusted Bart like a son, molded him into an assassin. Bart even wanted to purchase 2 white tigers so he could be like Mike. And yes, it was true, absolutely, what Gabriel had said. Bart was nothing but 13 when he joined up. Miguel practically raised him, sent him to a special force military camp where he always got the highest scores in guns, explosives, hand-to-hand combat, how to move as a ghost. Then he was sent to different places around the nation, to unknown places. The only evidence of his being there, a trail of dead bodies. Robert had interviewed dozens of killers. They all went straight to the excuses, the justifications. But for whatever bullshit Bart fed Robert, he was the first murderer who came right out and said that he killed not because he was from poverty or because his mother didn't hold him enough as a baby. He killed because he liked to kill. Robert's feelings for Bart were complicated. Sure, the kid had wanted to whack his ass, had even threatened his family, but Robert liked him. He actually liked the kid. Bart's candor was certainly part of his charm, but so perhaps was his naivete. Surprised to discover that his forthrightness in the debriefings would curry no favor with the state court on the murder charges for Moises Garcia and Noe Flores, Bart was also deeply hurt when Robert told him that Gabriel gave him up on the Flores murder. Bart wondered, how could his brother do that? Robert pretended to empathize, playing up the betrayal until Bart decided to challenge his case and go to trial. The following summer, all of downtown Laredo was secured during Bart's state trial, with squad cars parked at every intersection near the courthouse. Robert took the stand and explained the investigation of the Flores murder, how the cell phone trail led to the tattoo artist. The tattoo artist, fearing for his family, took the witness stand and pleaded with the judge to send him home. When Christina took the stand, she was so scared that she refused to confirm anything she'd said in her deposition a day earlier. The Lord, per Isaiah 3:16, had laid bare her secret parts, taken away the bracelets, scarves, and perfume. Due to her involvement in the case, she was fired from her job at a bank. In Bart's trial, however, neither the tattoo artist nor Christina was necessary. The evidence against Bart was heavy. On the third day of trial, he decided to end it and plead guilty. "I hope you take the time in prison to reflect on your life," the judge told Bart as he announced a sentence of 70 years. "It's a young life." It was unclear how many people on Miguel's list of 40 avoided being killed. Interviews and debriefings helped Laredo PD identify many targets on the list. Mike Lopez, the Laredo smuggler who slept with Miguel's ex-girlfriend, ignored law enforcement's advice to leave Laredo. In 2007, a gang member from the Texas Syndicate murdered Lopez while he was standing in front of a Laredo bar that he had just opened. New informants cycled through Robert's office, and he learned some interesting facts. Miguel had been wrong about the next president being on lock. The company bet on the wrong horse. The company now wanted to execute President-elect Felipe Calderon for refusing the bribe. Company brass believed Calderon favored the Sinaloa cartel. When Calderon took office at the end of 2006, the Harvard grad said he planned to wage war on the cartels. If he did, Washington's Merida initiative would send Mexico $1.5 billion in crime-fighting aid. It wasn't much, next to the approximately $50 billion a year in tax-free business, about 5% of Mexican GDP, that drug users did with the cartels. But it was enough to buy a war. Calderon launched his ill-fated effort to purge Mexico of the cartels. In Mexico, the cartels quickly saw the difficulty of fighting each other and Calderon's government. In 2007, Chapo Guzman met Heriberto Lazcano at a hotel in Valle Hermoso. They agreed to divide the country. The meeting ended with a party and enemies coming together over whiskey and cocaine. But, like most promises in the cartel world, the Valle Hermoso Pact was short-lived. Far from ending the conflict, it marked the beginning of its most bloody phase. The cartels fought the government, rival cartels, and even fought among themselves. Catorce, the original Zeta who co-led the organization with Lazcano and ran the company's business in Veracruz, was shot dead at a Veracruz horse race, possibly on orders from Miguel. After Catorce's death, Miguel killed Catorce's loyalists in the company and plotted his rise. The Mexican drug war had begun. Gabriel Cardona never got his shot at La Barbie. But Gabriel and the other Wolf boys served their masters well. By the end of 2006, the Zetas and the Gulf Cartel had repelled the Sinaloans and maintained the company's grip on the Gulf Coast and the Laredo Crossing. La Barbie scrambled. He separated from his first wife, his high school sweetheart, and married Priscilla, the teenage daughter of a Laredo trafficking associate. But La Barbie was losing friends and money fast. Via his attorney, he contacted the DEA office in Laredo. DEA wanted an informant to help capture Arturo Beltran Leyva, ABL, the Sinaloan associate who was La Barbie's boss, as well as Chapo, the Sinaloan head. La Barbie told DEA that he would surrender only under certain conditions, from an internal DEA memo. 1. Valdez Villarreal will provide information and intelligence on top corrupt Mexican government officials whom DEA and other federal agencies in Mexico work with. 2. Will not provide information on cartel leaders discussed in the first negotiation. 3. If and when arrested, Valdez Villarreal wants to immediately be extradited to the U.S. 4. Wants immunity from prosecution for himself and two of his cousins. 5. Does not want to testify against any person who he provides information on. Legal considerations still need to be reviewed by AUSA Angel Moreno, the memo said. The terms agreed upon by the district office and the McAllen district office are listed below. 1. Valdez Villarreal must agree to meet with agents of the DEA in a neutral country in order to fully debrief. 2. Valdez Villarreal must provide information which will result in the arrest of one of three cartel leaders, Beltran Leyva, Guzman Noera, or Zambada Garcia. 3. Valdez Villarreal will not be granted full immunity from prosecution, possibly consider minimum jail time. 4. Valdez Villarreal will turn himself in to U.S. authorities at a U.S. port of entry or a country where extradition is possible. And 5. Valdez Villarreal will surrender an amount equal to the amount he wants to bring into the U.S. Valdez Villarreal has expressed his desire to bring $5 million into the U.S. La Barbie offered to help nab ABL or Chapo, but not both. Laredo agents were eager to strike a deal, but their boss in Houston quashed the negotiations. He's a fucking doper. If he doesn't want to cooperate, screw him. At the time, the American government was talking to one of its biggest cartel cooperators, Ociel Cardenas, the Gulf Cartel leader, from whose mind the Zetas sprung a decade earlier, was extradited to the States in 2007 and sentenced in 2010. Eligible for a life sentence, Ociel was scheduled for release in 2025. His plea agreement remained sealed. But Ociel, through his own informant, passed along information to U.S. authorities about drug loads and the whereabouts of Gulf Cartel and Zeta underbosses, the kind of meaningful, real-time intelligence that only a top capo could possess. There may have also been an exchange of money between Ociel and the U.S. government. In 2013, in a Zeta-related federal trial in Washington, D.C., a former Zeta lieutenant would testify that the company sent $60 million for Ociel to use in the United States to lower his sentence. The government excluded this testimony from the public record and denied the author's request pursuant to the Freedom of Information Act. The transcript, provided to the author by a confidential source, shows that the judge held a private meeting with the lawyers and said, "The witness implied that $60 million was sent here to help reduce OCL's sentence. Are we going to let that stay just the way it is on the record?" The judge added, "It leaves a certain implication that one would like to have cleared up if the $60 million was going to affect his sentence. I hope that wasn't the case. If it was $60 million to pay an attorney, maybe we could bring that out rather than making it sound like something different." The issue was never resolved and never raised again on the record. The Kingpin strategy, in which American and Mexican authorities sought to dismantle cartels by going after their top leaders, was not just a fallacy.